Welcome to iHeartRadio Communities, a public affairs special focusing on the biggest issues impacting you this week. Here's Ryan Gorman.
Thanks for joining us here on iHeartRadio Communities. I'm Ryan Gorman, and we have some important conversations lined up for you. In a moment, I'll check in with an expert on hurricanes to talk about this current hurricane season and what to expect for the rest of the year. And I'll talk to Steve Bowen, Managing Director and Head of Catastrophe Insight at Aon, about the record heat out west and the risk for another record wildfire season. First, to get things started, I'm joined by Dr. Phil Klotzbach, research scientist in the Department of Atmospheric Science at Colorado State University, who's with us to talk about hurricane season. Following a record season in 2020, we're already seeing an active season so far here in 2021. Dr. Klotzbach, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us about this. And let's start with some of the basics, like what a hurricane actually is and what it is that makes them unique.
Yeah. So, first of all, thanks for having me. And we get hurricanes are basically tropical cyclone is a more generic term. So these are basically low pressure areas that develop near the or in the tropics in general. And they typically form during the summer months. So in the northern hemisphere, that's usually between June and November, and then in the southern hemisphere, they go usually between about November and April. And so basically what happens is in the Atlantic Ocean, most of the hurricanes come from what are known as easterly waves, or basically large clusters of thunderstorms that actually start over the Ethiopian highlands and move from east to west across Africa. And then there's about 60 to 70 of those every year. And then if the environment is conducive in the Atlantic Ocean, then they potentially could intensify into a tropical storm or into a hurricane. So if the environment's conducive, that means basically you have warm waters, because hurricanes need that warm ocean waters as primary fuel source. They also need basically what's known as low levels of vertical wind shear, which is the change in wind direction with height in the atmosphere. Too much of that shear tears apart hurricanes. So if you have a lower shear environment like the Atlantic normally has, especially during August, September, and October, you can get these storms intensifying into tropical storms and hurricanes, and if the environment is extremely conducive, even into major hurricanes.
I want to go back to something you alluded to a moment ago, because it's a question that always comes up: why these systems roll off the coast of Africa. Can you go a little bit more in depth into that process?
Yes. So basically, again, we have these basically what are known as easterly waves, or what they are is really clusters of strong thunderstorms, and they initiate over the Ethiopian highlands. And then in the tropics, the winds at low levels blow out of the east. So they blow from the east to the west. So these strong thunderstorm complexes basically move all the way across Western Africa, usually emerge off of the west coast of Africa near Senegal. And then again, if the environment is conducive, then those thunderstorm complexes can intensify into tropical storms and hurricanes. In addition to forming in the Atlantic, the system or these tropical waves, if they don't form in the Atlantic, can sometimes actually develop in the eastern Pacific Ocean as well, so off the west coast of Mexico. So that's basically the primary reason why we get most of the hurricanes in the Atlantic forming from systems off of Africa, is just because basically there's elevated terrain over Ethiopia where these thunderstorms kind of initiate, and then again they propagate from east to west across Africa and then into the Atlantic Ocean.
And there is also the possibility for hurricanes to develop later in the hurricane season in the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico, correct?
That's correct. And especially in the Caribbean, often those are still coming from waves. So the system's coming off Africa. So for example, last year, the listeners might remember like hurricanes Eta and Iota, which brought really significant impacts to Nicaragua and Honduras. Both of those actually formed from waves coming off Africa. They didn't form, in the eastern or central Atlantic. It took till they got to the Caribbean where the environment was more conducive for them to form. In the Gulf of Mexico, sometimes there's waves, oftentimes too. You can also get hurricanes forming basically off of sometimes fronts, cold fronts that make their way into the Gulf of Mexico. Sometimes you can get stuff spinning up off of those as well. So there's a variety of different mechanisms that hurricanes can form from, but the primary method, I think about 80% of all major hurricanes form from these waves coming off Africa.
I'm joined by Dr. Phil Klotzbach, research scientist in the Department of Atmospheric Science at Colorado State University. We're talking about hurricanes and hurricane seasons. So the storms that we're familiar with along the East Coast of the United States and the Gulf Coast, those are the same types of storms that we also see in the Pacific, even though they're called something different over there, right?
That's correct. So hurricanes in the Atlantic, their counterpart in the Western Pacific Ocean, so near, say, Japan, China, Korea, those are known as typhoons. So basically, but the generic term that is often used is cyclone or tropical cyclone. And that's used, that can be used anywhere. So Atlantic, Pacific, even in the Indian Ocean, all can be referred to as tropical cyclones. But the more specific term in the Atlantic and in the Eastern North Pacific is hurricane, and in the Western North Pacific is typhoon.
And then the ingredients that you were talking about earlier that impact the size and intensity as we continue through hurricane season, when these storms start to develop, what is it that everyone should look out for to get a sense as to whether or not this could turn into a serious storm, perhaps a major hurricane?
Yeah, so if you look at the discussions that the National Hurricane Center puts out when they're writing advisories on a particular storm, like, for example, Elsa, what they look at is you look at things like how warm the waters are. If the waters are warmer than normal, that tends to provide more fuel for the storm. It also tends to make the atmosphere a little more unstable, which helps basically just helps to make a stronger hurricane. Another thing, again, that they talk about a lot is this what's known as vertical wind shear. So basically, in the Atlantic, in general, your low-level winds, your winds at low levels in the atmosphere blow out of the east, and at upper levels, they blow out of the west. So basically, there's a shear between low levels and upper levels. So there's a change in wind direction with height. If there's a lot of that shear, that's bad for the hurricane, good for the people in the hurricane's path. Whereas if there's low shear, then these storms can really intensify quickly. And like, for example, last year, we had a ton of storm activity, especially late. And that's because we had really, really low levels of that wind shear. And that really allowed these storms to ramp up and intensify into being these strong hurricanes.
Are there certain atmospheric conditions that lead to lower wind shear or higher wind shear? How does that work?
Yeah, so when we do our seasonal forecast, one of the big things that we talk about every year is, are we going to have El Nino conditions or not? Now, El Nino is warmer than normal water in the eastern and central tropical Pacific Ocean. When you have an El Nino event in the tropical Pacific Ocean, it tends to increase those upper level winds, so winds at say 20, 30,000 feet in the atmosphere. It increases them out of the west, and that tends to tear apart hurricanes as they're developing and intensifying. So when we do our seasonal forecast, one of the big things we look for every year is, are we going to have El Nino conditions or not? For example, 2015, we had a very strong El Nino event, and it was a very quiet Atlantic hurricane season with a lot of wind shear. Last year, we had effectively the opposite of El Nino, which is known as La Nina. When you have La Nina conditions, that tends to be much more conducive, weaker upper level winds. And that's what we saw last year, which is one of the reasons why we had such an active hurricane season last year.
I'm joined by Dr. Phil Klotzbach, research scientist in the Department of Atmospheric Science at Colorado State University. We're talking about hurricanes and hurricane season. As we're all watching these storms make their way towards the United States, usually once they start to get to the Caribbean, we hear about the impact that land and mountainous regions could have on the storm. Can you talk a little bit about that and step us through how that affects the size and intensity of a hurricane?
Yes. So basically, hurricanes live off of warm ocean water. So when they run out of that warm ocean water, aka go over land, that is detrimental for the hurricane. So hurricanes will weaken when they go over land. Now, there is a difference. So if a hurricane goes over fairly flat land, say a small island, it might not be particularly impacted. But if you have a lot of topography, so you have high mountains, for example, parts of Cuba and Haiti and Dominican Republic, that can really, really significantly impact the hurricane circulation, such that it'll weaken really, really dramatically. And that's one of the challenges with these forecasts for an individual storm is that, you know, a lot of these land masses, especially in the Caribbean and central, or especially Caribbean, are fairly small, but they may have tall mountains. So very subtle changes in the track can make big differences as to how impacted these hurricanes are by the mountainous terrain. For example, a couple of years ago with Hurricane Dorian, there was a thought for a while that it might significantly be impacted by the Dominican Republic. And if that had been the case and the system had gone over the high mountains there, perhaps it would have been torn apart and really wouldn't have been that much of a storm. The storm unfortunately tracked farther to the east, completely avoided that land, and was able to ramp up into the very, very powerful hurricane that it ended up becoming.
taking a look back historically, what are some of the regions, some of the parts of the United States that are most susceptible to hurricanes?
Yeah, so if you look historically at hurricanes, you know, the state that gets hit the most is Florida. And that makes sense for a couple of reasons. One, basically the state kind of sits in the kind of the predominant track of where these storms go. But also, obviously, a state like Florida or a state like Texas has a large amount of coastline. So, for example, you know, it's hard to get a hurricane making landfall, say, in Alabama because the coast of Alabama is fairly short. Whereas a state like Florida or Texas obviously has a much larger coastline. And obviously then gets hit more often. Louisiana also is hit fairly often by hurricanes. Obviously last year, they were really under the gun last year, getting hit by three separate hurricanes.
And then we have seen hurricanes stay in the Atlantic Ocean and brush up or directly hit the Carolinas and that part of the U.S. What would cause that to happen?
Yes. And so typically what kind of steers most hurricanes, especially ones coming off Africa, is basically what's known as the Bermuda high pressure area. And so that's a semi-permanent high pressure area near Bermuda. But it doesn't basically just park over Bermuda every year. It can shift east, it can shift west, it can be stronger, it can be weaker. And so basically a lot of the storms, kind of a nice garden variety hurricane doesn't impact anyone, will track generally from east to west across the Atlantic. And then what they'll do is they'll reach basically the western edge of that high pressure area and start tracking to the north. And once a storm gets far enough north, instead of being steered from east to west by low-level winds, it'll get picked up by the jet stream and get pushed from west to east. And often what's known as that will be called like recurvature. A storm will basically recurve out into the open ocean and impact no one. Whereas if that Bermuda high is shifted a little farther to the west, those storms will start to recurve. But instead of recurving out into the open Atlantic Ocean, they may recurve too close and end up hitting especially the Outer Banks of North Carolina, is obviously a fairly frequent target for tropical storms and hurricanes because it kind of sits in the predominant storm track of where these storms usually go. And again, if they don't recurve far enough east, often they will actually come up and cause potential impacts, especially in North Carolina and even down into South Carolina.
I'm joined by Dr. Phil Klotzbach, research scientist in the Department of Atmospheric Science at Colorado State University. We're discussing hurricanes and hurricane season. And let's get to some of the different aspects of these storms, from storm surge to wind speeds to rainfall to hurricanes, which can develop, especially in those outer bands that make their way through different regions when a hurricane is approaching. Why would that kind of severe weather be present within this larger system?
Yeah, so basically what happens is it's tornadoes and hurricanes are basically spun up due to basically when you have these strong winds, that typically are blowing over the ocean, once they encounter land, the frictional effects of that will help to try to spin up some of these tornadoes. Often the tornadoes with hurricanes are fairly weak, but you can get stronger hurricanes, an EF2, even maybe an EF3, that can cause significant levels of damage. And like you said, they can often be in these outer bands. And unfortunately, it's hard to be able to know, you know, days in advance how many tornadoes a storm is going to spin up, but that can be another potential threat. So normally when I think of the biggest threats from hurricanes, obviously your number one threat that everyone always thinks about is the wind. Obviously you have the wind because you have a hurricane, but you also have the storm surge, which is effectively the increase in the water level driven by the fact that you have these strong winds. And then you also have the rainfall, which can obviously be potentially the worst-ish impact from a hurricane, especially if it's a slow-moving hurricane. Or if a hurricane is tracking over an area with a lot of topography, that can force more rain out of the storm as well. So there's a variety of different threats a hurricane poses. And obviously with the wind threat, you have the predominant winds associated with the hurricane, but then you can get even stronger winds in some of these tornadoes. We saw some with Elsa, and we saw a lot with Claudette as well. So that's another potential threat with hurricanes.
Now, over at Colorado State University, you put out predictions for each hurricane season. What are we looking at this year? We've already seen, a very active season so far, a record-setting season, right?
That's correct. Yeah, we had the earliest fifth named storm on record with Elsa. And normally, early season storm activity doesn't really relate well with the rest of the season activity. So basically, just because you had a bunch of storms early on doesn't necessarily say much. But if you get storm activity forming in basically what we call like the deep tropics, so say south of the Tropic of Cancer, so really in the tropics, and especially tracking into places like the Eastern Caribbean. If you look historically, when we've had storms there in June and July, they've been very, very active hurricane seasons. And typically, you know, we hurricane season starts June 1st, but a lot of the stuff you get early on tends to form a little bit higher latitudes, maybe more in the Gulf of Mexico. You don't necessarily get many storms in the eastern and central Atlantic until you get into August, when the environment tends to be much more conducive. So if you get these early season storm activity, that tends to be a harbinger of a potentially very active season. So that's one of the reasons with the seasonal forecast that we put out, that the forecast did actually come up a bit. We're now forecasting a total of 20 named storms, 9 hurricanes, and 4 major hurricanes. We've already had 5 storms, and then one hurricane being Elsa. So 15 additional storms, 8 additional hurricanes, and 4 additional major hurricanes.
Taking a look back at the past couple of years, have we seen an increase in the amount of storms that are forming, including the amount of major hurricanes that are being produced? And also, there seems to be this issue of rapid intensification, where storms just get real strong as they approach the coastline. Is that new and different, or is that something that we have seen at other points in history?
Yeah, so with the Atlantic, we certainly have seen more major hurricanes since around 1995. If you go back to 1970s and 1994, the Atlantic was quite a bit quieter. Now, if you go back prior to that, from like the mid-1920s to late 1960s, the Atlantic was much more active. It's a little hard to know exactly how active it was, just given we have much better ways to observe hurricanes now than we did, say, especially in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. We didn't have satellite data. We weren't flying planes into the storms until we got to about the late 1940s. Even in the 50s and 60s, we may have missed a few of these weaker storms. And then if you go back even further, it looks like from 1900 to 25 was pretty quiet. And then the late 19th century was very active, especially for U.S. landfall. So there tends to be kind of this cyclical pattern of overall hurricane activity, potentially driven both by internal oscillations in the ocean. And then there's obviously also the question about climate change and its potential impacts. And you touched on a phenomenon effectively known as rapid intensification, where these hurricanes are strengthening by what usually is used as 35 miles an hour or more in 24 hours. So say a hurricane had 75 mile an hour winds yesterday, today it has 110 mile an hour winds, it underwent rapid intensification. And so we've certainly seen a lot of that in recent years, especially last year was kind of a poster child for rapid intensification. And so if you look at the data, yes, you do see an increase in rapid intensification, especially in these really what we call like high-end rapid intensifications, those storms intensifying by 50, 60, 70 miles an hour in a day. The question is, of course, with the observations that we have going back in time, you know, some of these earlier storms may have undergone similar levels of rapid intensification. We just didn't have the technology to observe them. But I would say overall, probably even assuming some of that underestimate, we probably are starting to see some increasing trend, especially in the highest end rapid intensification. So storms intensifying by 50, 60, 70 miles an hour. And that makes sense given with climate change, the warming oceans tends to provide basically a little better background environment for these storms to undergo these rapid intensification events. And obviously from a preparation and preparedness or preparation perspective and a mitigation perspective, rapid intensification can be really problematic, especially when it occurs near land. Because if, for example, one day you've got a Category 1 hurricane, and the next day it's a Category 4, that's a whole different beast in terms of its impact. And so there's a lot of work being done on better being able to forecast and predict these rapidly intensifying hurricanes.
Yeah, Hurricane Michael comes to mind with rapid intensification, because that was a storm that I think a lot of people weren't paying a whole lot of attention to. Then all of a sudden, we learn it's Category 5.
Yeah, that's a great point. Michael kind of came out of nowhere. I was actually overseas when Michael, a few days before Michael, and I remember looking at the weather models and saying, oh, good, you know, I'll come back and it should be pretty quiet. And then, you know, a few days later, here we are looking at a Category 5 hurricane. And the thing with Michael was it developed in the Caribbean and then went north into the Gulf of Mexico. And the environment was kind of marginal, but it found kind of this one area in the Gulf where the conditions were a lot more conducive than the overall conditions were in the Gulf. And it was able to undergo this rapid intensification. And I think it certainly caught a lot of people by surprise. I think there were indications it might be a hurricane, but certainly, yeah, I don't think many people thought it was going to be a Category 5 hurricane, and obviously caused a tremendous amount of impact where it made landfall in Mexico Beach area. And obviously, too, it made landfall in a fairly sparsely populated portion of the coastline. You know, had Michael made landfall, you know, in New Orleans or in Tampa or, you know, in the Houston area, you know, the damage from that storm could have been much, much worse in terms of an overall economic damage perspective. While obviously it still was incredibly devastating for the area where it did make landfall. So, you know, I mean, it's in terms of its impact, it was certainly an extremely impactful storm.
Dr. Phil Klotzbach, research scientist in the Department of Atmospheric Science at Colorado State University. Dr. Klotzbach, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to break all of that down for us. We appreciate your expertise.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Take care.
All right. And finally, I'm joined by Steve Bowen, Managing Director and Head of Catastrophe Insight at Aon, to talk about the heat wave out west that has set so many records and also the wildfire seasons that we have seen in recent years and what to expect on that front this year here in 2021. Steve, thanks so much for taking a few minutes to join us. And let's start with that heat wave out west. Can you put things into perspective, the extent of it and where it stands historically?
Sure. Well, thank you very much for having me. And oftentimes we hear the word unprecedented used to describe extreme weather events that tend to occur. But this is really one event where unprecedented is the perfect word. The level of record heat that we saw across the Pacific Northwest and then in the southern parts of Canada, the western parts of Canada, was really something we've never seen before in the modern record. All-time temperature records broken by at least 11 degrees Fahrenheit. That really is unprecedented. Typically, anytime you break an all-time temperature record by 1 to 2 degrees, it's a big
right.
deal. Anytime above 5 degrees, it's an even bigger deal. But 11 degrees is just pretty much unheard of. In fact, it's a national record in terms of the difference between the all-time record and a second highest temperature in an individual state. And that was actually set in a town in Washington. But in terms of the likelihood of an event like this having occurred, the statistics are less than a fraction of 1% in any given year that this would happen. So what we call a 1 in 1,000 year return period. So a very unusual event. We had this heat dome, which essentially just sat for consecutive days, and it just really amplified these extremely hot conditions, even in areas along the coast, especially in, say, Seattle, where typically you get the cool breeze off the Pacific Ocean. But this was an event that broke many, many records and is going to be studied for a long time to come.
One of the questions I'm sure everybody out west has right now: is it over? Is it likely to continue throughout the summer? What are the expectations moving forward?
Sure. So the fact of the matter is that this happened at the end of June. It was quite concerning, especially since it really is not typically the peak part of the summer. I know in coming days there is a likelihood of another major heat wave across much of the West. I highly doubt it's going to be quite as extreme as what we saw in the latter part of June, but given how significant the drought has been across much of the West, in fact, it's a record drought. We've never seen drought conditions or the expanse of drought conditions like this in this century. It's quite concerning, especially as we're getting into the peak of wildfire season. And I think we tend to focus primarily on California. But as we saw in 2020, that many states last year were affected by record fires as well. So we're hoping that we're not going to see a repeat of that as we did in 2020.
Could we end up seeing record heat in other parts of the country? Could this extend beyond the West Coast into, say, the Midwest or the Northeast?
Of course. Anytime you get an atmospheric setup where you get what we call a ridge of high pressure that sits and it's essentially blocked by other areas of low pressure, basically the jet stream gets stuck and you get very warm winds and dry winds, and oftentimes, you're tapping into moisture coming out of the Gulf of Mexico. You can get very humid conditions, which leads to pretty significant heat. We have seen temperatures rise well above 100 degrees in many parts of the plains, getting up in the Midwest. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that we could definitely see this type of heat extending elsewhere, further east, away from the West Coast.
I'm joined right now by Steve Bowen, Managing Director and Head of Catastrophe Insight at Aon. We're talking about this record heat wave that we've seen out west, and you alluded to the record number of wildfires that we've seen out there in recent years as well. First of all, can you tell us how impactful, how extensive the wildfire situation has been in recent years compared to what we had seen there historically?
Yeah, so in terms of the actual damage that's been incurred, the last, say, 4 to 5 years is really without precedent. We have not seen this before. From a financial loss standpoint, we're talking tens of billions of dollars worth of damage to homes and businesses. So we have never seen losses at that extent before in history. In terms of the size of the fires, way back when there were differences in terms of firefighting techniques, fire suppression techniques were different. We've certainly seen fires that burned, significant levels of expense. But in the modern record, where we've seen much more population moving, we have not seen, this level of fire conflagration across many parts of the West in many, many decades. So, it's certainly unprecedented from that regard. And what makes the risk more concerning is that more people continue to move into these, what we deem known fire locations. So when these events do happen, there's just frankly more people at risk and more stuff to potentially burn. And of course, when you have more people there, it does create more challenges in terms of allowing proper mitigation, proper fire suppression techniques by firefighters to try to minimize the risk out there. But something is going to have to be done because as we've seen, the losses continue to go up. Unfortunately, that leads to more human fatalities as well. But it's a dangerous risk. We know that it's there, and hopefully people will recognize at their own location that the steps that they can take to try to minimize the risk at their own home.
The correlation between record heat and the potential for wildfires, is this essentially, in a way, fuel for these fires?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've definitely seen over the course of many decades a change in terms of the length of what we call the fire season, and then the rainy season, which typically began in early October and goes into the spring. But what has happened is we've seen an extension of these summer-like conditions, this record heat that extends well into the fall, and sometimes going into December until we actually see that precipitation arrive. And when that happens, it means you have much more opportunity for fires to burn. And if you have a previous year where there was some decent precipitation, you get a lot of vegetative growth. But if you follow that with record heat, all of that growth dies out. And it becomes it's available fuel that becomes extremely flammable and very conducive for rapid spread. So, the conditions themselves have definitely trended more dangerous over time as temperatures go up and the soils become much more prevalent for this type of extreme fire behavior. But of course, the ignition is what really causes this, and whether it's a power line, whether it's, someone that, we've seen in, it's almost a joke at this point, but more folks are doing these gender reveal parties, which have unfortunately spawned a lot of fires out west as well. So, it's a lot of very complex things working together, but unfortunately the risk continues to get worse when you put it all together.
One final question for you, and again, I'm joined by Steve Bowen, Managing Director and Head of Catastrophe Insight at Aon. Beyond the obvious effects of this extreme heat and these record wildfire seasons, we've seen the impact reach other areas like the power grid, or in Portland and Seattle recently with this record heat, you had pavement buckling. Can you talk about some of the cascading effects, the broader impact that we see from this extreme weather?
Absolutely. And this is really an important topic around, say, climate resilience, where we have infrastructure that was built for an environment that is not what we have today. And we actually, you can talk about this in context, what we saw in Texas in February, where the electrical grid there was not winterized to properly withstand this type of extreme temperature. And in that instance, of course, it was extreme cold. But in terms of heat, the level of heat stress that can go on aging infrastructure, it can lead to the pictures that we saw. And there's going to have to need to be an investment in planning for what tomorrow's climate is going to look like. Because, frankly, the weather and climate that we saw, say, 20, 30 years ago is probably not coming back in our lifetime just based on the trends that we've seen. So, a lot of preparation and mitigation steps are going to have to be taken to, look at the trends, see where things are continuing to evolve and build better, because, when it comes to infrastructure, it's critical in terms of our daily livelihood.
Steve Bowen, Managing Director and Head of Catastrophe Insight at Aon. Steve, really appreciate the time and insight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, and that'll do it for this edition of iHeartRadio Communities. As we wrap things up, I want to offer a big thanks to all of our guests and, of course, to all of you for listening. We'll be back same time, same place next weekend. Stay safe.